In this four-part mini-series of Judaism Unbound, we're learning about and experiencing firsthand a fascinating Yiddish book called Bovobuch. This mini-series is presented in partnership with Theater Dibbuk, a Los Angeles-based organization that creates provocative performances and innovative educational encounters, exploring Jewish thought to illuminate universal human experience. Learn more about their work at www.theaterdibbuk.org. That's www.theaterdibbuk.org.
A long time ago, there lived in Lombardy.
The king looked him over from top to bottom and then had him trot up and down.
So she set off for the city, riding faster than an arrow.
So that they might seize and bind Bovo.
She shouted out to them, and when the sailors saw what it was.
And as I held him in my arms, his spirit left him.
Take everything you want and do not suppose I'll deny you anything.
Welcome to Bovobuch, Chivalric Romance, Cultural Collision. This is Aaron Henney, Artistic Director of Theater Dibbuk. This series is produced by Theater Dibbuk and presented in collaboration with Judaism Unbound. Over the course of three episodes, we will take you on a journey through the 16th century Yiddish text, Bovobuch, using it as an opportunity to discuss issues of assimilation, dominance and subjugation, sexuality and gender, and so much more. This first episode will touch on the content of the book itself and the cultural context within which it was created. You will hear me in conversation with scholar Irit Jaffe Berg, alongside readings from the text performed by actors associated with Theater Dibbuk. These readings are taken from the published English translation of Bovobuch by Jerry C. Smith. In addition, in the introduction, you heard a selection of the original Yiddish read by Miri Korl of the California Institute for Yiddish Culture and Language. Lastly, there are a variety of accents and dialects used throughout the piece, a combination of Hebrew pronunciations, Yiddish pronunciations, and anglicized versions of certain words. This is purposeful and meant to reflect the complex ways in which language is shared and passed down through the ages. And now, let us begin Bovobuch, Chivalric Romance, Cultural Collision. Episode 1, Story and Society.
Ich. Elia Levi, der Schreiber, zu Dienst alle jiddische Weiber. Komm itzt mit mein Wort dem Bedachten, es lohnt sich darauf zu vertrachten. Mit heilige Schrift.
And so, finally, at long last, I will begin with this book called Bovo. It has been 34 years now since I first wrote it. I based it on an Italian book, but I have added much that is my own. Whoever reads my book will understand it, although there are few Italian words in it. If anyone does not recognize them, let him look at the very last pages of this book, where I have listed these words in alphabetical order and briefly defined them. I sing this story to an Italian melody, but I cannot describe it for you. Someone who knows music and the scales would have to do that, or, for that matter, write a better tune for it. He would have my thanks.
Irit, I'd like to open it up and welcome you and say thank you for being here and would love to hear about the work.
Thank you so much, Aaron, and I'm looking forward to exploring the Bovobuch with you and with the listeners for the next few episodes. So let me say a little bit about Bovobuch, the text. This is a chivalric romance written in Yiddish by a man named Elia Levita. It was written in 1507, and then it was published in 1541. In its day, it was a very popular book and received many reprintings. And I would say that it should be considered, it is considered, a treasure of Yiddish literature and of early modern culture. And so it's very exciting to share this with people who are new to the Bovobuch and to see what kind of creative imaginings it inspires further. That said, I should add that it was not a totally original book. It was based on circulated stories about a character named Bovo, who was the main hero of the Bovobuch. For example, there was the Anglo-Norman Bevis of Hampton, who was translated to the Italian Bovo d'Antona, which then inspired Bovobuch. So from the get-go, this is a book or a chivalric romance that reflects on many different cultures, a subject that I know we'll want to come back to later in our podcast. My own story in coming to know about Beauvaubourg, because unfortunately it was not a story I grew up with. Like many people, I grew up with the expression Bobemeise, like a nonsense tale or a grandmother's tale. But I didn't know that that expression, Bobemeise, stems from this particular actual literary work. So a few years ago, when I was in the National Library in Jerusalem, I came across a book about Yiddish works in Italy. And the book is called Yiddish in Italia, Yiddish Manuscripts and Printed Books from the 15th to the 17th Century. And it's edited by scholars Chava Trinyansky, Erica Tim, with the collaboration of Claudia Rosenzweig. And the Yiddish chivalric romance was mentioned there, but I didn't really know what it was. And so I made a note, a mental note, as we do, to go back to it and to look at it as soon as I could. And so a few years later, when I finally read the romance in an English translation by Jerry Smith a couple of years ago, I loved it. I fell in love with it. It reads like a wild adventure story with some bizarre references to Jewish culture and Yiddish thrown in. It seems naturally theatrical to me. I'm so pleased that we're exploring this with Theater D-Book during this period of closure and staying at home, because it seems to me that this type of oral storytelling comes alive in periods in which we're limited in our ability to experience live theater, but we have a different way of exploring our creativity. And maybe this is a way for us in the 21st century to envision how important and alive the act of reading aloud must have been to the early modern people, when not everyone had access to court theater and not everyone could go to performances in the piazza all the time. So let me return to the story of the Beauvaubourg, or the tale, or the maase in Hebrew, or the maase in Yiddish of Beauvau. So in Beauvaubourg, our main hero is named, not surprisingly, Bobo. And he is described, interestingly, as a very beautiful boy. He's beautiful in his youth. He remains good-looking as a young man and later in life. And the fact that he's so handsome is something that is emphasized in the narration again and again. He's born to the nobility, which of course might already raise an eyebrow because, hold on a second, this is a tale of Yiddish about Bovo. Is Bovo Jewish? How could he be born to the nobility, right? So this is absolutely ironic, of course, given that he is supposed to, in the narration, also be Jewish. And, you know, he can't really be a lord, a Jewish lord at this time. So it's an example of how the original story written in a Christian context is overlaid onto a Jewish context. And sometimes in that cultural translation process, improbabilities appear. Bobo is born to a mother named Brandonia, who's married to a much older man whom it's clear she does not love. And then she contrives, of course, to have her husband killed, but fears that her son Bovo will eventually avenge his father's murder. So very un-Jewish motherly-like, she contrives to have Bovo killed. This is a horrific idea to any, you know, to anybody, but you know, it goes against every maternal instinct, of course.
A long time ago, there lived in Lombardy a most noble count without equal, far and wide. Count Guidon was the good man's name, a strong warrior tested in battle. For many years he had reigned in the city of Antona, and now he had reached the age of 60. The book tells us that the high-born count had remained unmarried all his life, and that he had nothing to do with women.
But then he reached that age when the more he covered himself up, the colder he got. Nothing seemed to warm him, and he acted as though he were freezing to death. His wise knights gave him counsel.
Gracious lord, have your people go out and find you some hot young wench who will warm you and take care of you.
Better for him had he lain alone longer. It was the daughter of the Count of Burgundy who was given to him in marriage. She had no equal between here and Babylon. She was as high-born as he, and she pleased him well. Her name was Brandonia the Fair. With him, she led a life of luxury, and whatever she desired was granted her. Her days were pleasant, her nights distressing. She warmed him in a fine fashion. If I told you more than that, I would bring disgrace upon myself. Fair Brandonia became pregnant, and through the grace of God bore a son. No one had ever beheld a more beautiful or a more comely child. They named him Bovo. You can well imagine his father's great joy. After a time, Count Guidon asked one of his barons to take the boy into his care and to be a proper guardian for him. The baron, whose name was Sinibald, gladly complied. He was the lord of San Simon, a mighty castle built on a high hill in the midst of a forest some 10 miles from Antona. The count said to Sinibald,
"Take my son and have your wife look after him. See that he's taken care of in every way. And when he cries, have someone sing to him."
Sinibald took the young lord and brought him to San Simon, to his wife. She gladly cared for Bovo, but soon she no longer knew what to do with him, for he grew up very quickly. As a boy of 10, he already had a grown man's body. Sinibald taught him to fence, to thrust, and to parry, and also how to joust. He was full of wild notions, pretending to harga, kill, and slay everyone. Now and then, he and 4 or 5 squires would go out riding and come visit his mother. But he gave her little joy, and she showed him no affection. She hated him, because he was his father's son, and it was not long before she wished to neither hear nor see him. One day she said to herself,
"Oy, vai! Alas, woe is me! Such heartfelt sorrow! My mother and father have done this to me! May God give them both the hillich, diarrhea! How could they have been so cruel to give me to that old fart? But I swear I'll not waste my life with him growing old and ugly. Whatever it takes, I'll find a way to get myself some fine young man, one who'll pass the time with me as I please."
Now, Brandonia had a courtier by the name of Ricardo, a man most skilled in evil. One day she called him to her chambers, those which the good count had built for her, and said,
"If you promise not to betray me, I'll entrust you with a matter of great importance, and I'll give you 1,000 ducats as well. If you refuse me, you'll be sorry. I'll scream that you tried to rape me and have you killed on the spot."
Ricardo said,
"Gracious lady, why threaten me so? You know there's nothing I wouldn't do for you, if you but asked."
"Clearly he's not killed. He is saved, rather. The first of many escapes. And the first time he's saved by a trusted family tutor. And he sets off on a journey that's going to take him across Europe and even much beyond Europe over the course of the tale. The plot is copious. It's sort of endless. Endless characters come into his life. Endless near-death experiences, endless forests, endless landscapes, endless adventures, twists, turns. And of course, there's romance. And some of these are amusing, some of these are exciting, some of these are perplexing in the cultural elements that they mix together, as we will see.
We will now hear a variety of selections from the text, aligned with Arit's observations of its twists and turns. This one tells of Bovo receiving help in order to be protected from the attempt on his life.
Now Bovo, who had come to Antona the day before to visit his mother, had heard the uproar and had hidden out of fear. His guardian, that worthy man Sinibald, was greatly concerned for the youth, not knowing where he had gone. He looked for him all through the house, behind all the casks and the sacks, and then he looked in the stables, in every nook and cranny. Bovo, who had hidden himself in a large hay rack that held the fodder for the horses, came out as soon as he heard his good guardian, threw both arms around him, and asked,
"Dear guardian, tell me, what's happened?"
And so Sinibald told him everything, including the sorry tale of his father. Then he quickly picked out those knights whom he knew of old to have always been loyal to Guidon, and told them that they would be well advised to come away with him and Bovo and flee to San Simon.
And now, after being locked away, Bovo learns of his mother's plot to kill him.
The chambermaid took the food and quickly brought it to the boy. When she unlocked the room, she saw him sitting there, too weak to stand, barely able to speak. When he came over to her, he had to crawl along the wall. He really was at death's door. He grabbed the chicken with both hands and was about to stuff some into his mouth. The chambermaid immediately knelt down beside him. She loved him as his father's child and said, "Dear son, listen closely to me. As you value your life, don't eat a bite. Your mother is trying to kill you. She has poisoned this chicken for you, and if you eat it, something terrible will happen to you." Now, the story has it that a little dog had slipped into the room when the chambermaid had opened the door. Weeping with fear for the boy, she said to him, "If you don't believe me, then see for yourself." With that, she sliced off a piece of the chicken and gave it to the dog, and before it could so much as gulp it down, it swelled up and died. As soon as Bovo saw this, he beat his breast and tore his hair.
"Oy vey! What is to become of me? How can I save myself? If I go out, someone is sure to recognize me."
Nonetheless, he decided to try to make his escape through the town. He started running as fast as he could, rushing through the crowds and dashing headlong through all the mud and filth.
Irit mentioned the wide-ranging nature of the plot and its ever-growing cast of characters. In this next section, only a single page in length, not only do we have Bovo, but also Druziana, his love interest, and Duke Oglin, the king's cousin, with whom Bovo has a violent encounter.
While she was standing there, kissing him on his red mouth, with both arms around him, someone came into the stables. In his hands, he was carrying the king's banner on a staff. His name was Duke Oglin, the king's cousin, and he had seen everything. He said,
"Druziana, what is the meaning of this outrageous behavior? One would think you're a whore. Indeed, I think you're well on your way to becoming one. Believe me, I'll find some way of punishing this lechery. I'll make you wish you'd never been born. The enemy has captured your father and are threatening to retzech, kill him. And you stand there carrying on with a servant boy. Are you not in the least dismayed at what has happened to your father? Stop giving me that steely look. May the devil, plague, strike you down."
He went on cursing and scolding in this fashion until Bovo had finally had enough of it. He said,
"Oh, stop your prattle,"
and with his fist struck him a mighty blow on the head. He felt it in every bone of his body and fell down so hard he bounced. Then he got up and ran away, leaving the king's banner behind. Druziana quickly picked it up while Bovo dashed out of the stables. She watched him go, and she sent her best prayers with him. Out on the road, Bovo saw many men fleeing in retreat from the heathens. He pleaded with them,
"Good men, take courage. Let's make a stand. Don't you know the saying? He who flees will be pursued, and he who doesn't fight will be slain."
Bovo's words had their effect, and many who had been panicked now came to their senses, took heart, and turned back with Bovo in the lead. They saw signs of a great slaughter all along the way. A hard stone would have been moved to pity. The slain lay there, some still warm, blood everywhere. Some had lost an arm or a leg, and blue intestines were coming out of those who had been shot with muskets. A number of the wounded had retreated, but some of the rest were still defending themselves as best as they could.
So, connected to the context in which this work is born, I would love to hear a bit about the author and his career trajectory and kind of how he came to this work, what we should know about him, which may also inform us about the world in which it is existing.
Mm-hmm. So Elia Levita's full Jewish name was Elia Halevi ben Asher Ashkenazi, long name. He was born in 1469, like his name suggests, Ashkenazi, in the regions of Ashkenaz, in a town close to Nuremberg. And then he moved to Italy, as many people from the Germanic lands did. He moves to Italy in the 1490s because life was better for Jews at the time in northern Italy. It was one of the few places where Jews could actually find some kind of protection and thrive. So he dies in Venice in 1549, a relatively long life for this period of time. He was known as Elia Bocher, which, as the researcher and the scholar Claudia Rosenzweig beautifully suggests in her book commentary on Bovo Buch, she suggests that the term Bocher, which usually means young man or young student, in this case could also be said to mean, and I'm quoting from her, a wandering intellectual or a scholar whose shifting circumstances ruled out the possibility of a stable position in the Jewish community. So I think that's very interesting, this kind of wandering identity, even within the Jewish identity, which says something about a man who was attracted to a story about a wandering soul and may also speak to his own background as a Jewish mystic. Among the things that he was famous for so many things, but he was famous for being a grammarian who taught Hebrew to Christian thinkers. And at this time, there were many what we call Christian Hebraists. There were many people who were Christian, but who were very interested in Hebraic texts. And so he was teaching to Christian thinkers such as Egidio da Viterbo in Rome and Georges de Selve in Venice. These are very important people, as well also as the French king, Francois I, who actually was very interested in having Elia Levita come to France and teach him. But Levita refused the offer because he knew that the Jews had been expelled from France, you know, in 1394. And he didn't want to be, as a Jew living in France under those circumstances, certainly he would have been, if not the only Jew, one of the few Jews, you know, living openly as a Jew at the time there. So you have a different level, many different interests that are coming together. And here he's modeling the book on a chivalric romance that was known in Italian, Bovo d'Antona, a very popular work in Italian that itself had been, as I said, adapted from an English book. And so you could see that he is interested in literary works, stories that are surfacing in different cultures at the time. It's also interesting that he writes, especially, he says, to appeal to women in the Jewish community who may not otherwise have benefited from his publications and works as a grammarian because they may not have been as conversant in Hebrew. But here he's writing a work that is very deliberately written in Yiddish. And clearly the women, the Ashkenazi, the Tedeschi, whose families were from Germanic lands, would have found it much more accessible to hear a story in Yiddish.
May his holy name give me the strength to complete this Yiddish rendering of an Italian tale. May he help me succeed so that no one laughs at my efforts. Now hearken, the story begins.
While Elia Levita offers a pious prayer at the top of the work, he also has a kind of wry sense of humor, inserting himself into the text and commenting on it at different times. For example, here is the author talking about his own sexual prowess at a moment of particular shyness that Bovo experiences with his love interest.
That would have never happened to Elia Bohor.
And here is the author commenting on the seemingly unbelievable nature of the tale he's telling.
This sounds like something someone would tell children in a fairy tale, but I swear it's true.
And here's one more where Levita offers a euphemism for sex and then briefly comments on his own coyness.
I think you know what I mean.
And I should note that the censorship lists in the Duchy of Mantua, which is also in northern Italy, it's in the Lombardy region of northern Italy, that the censorship lists provide information about the kind of books that are owned by Jews in the area at the time. And it's very interesting that among the most popular books were chivalric romances. The famous one, of course, that we all know of is Ariosto's Orlando Furioso, which appeared in 1516. It says a lot about the kind of cultural openness within the Jewish community to these other texts. This was not the insular Jewish world that we sometimes think of when we think of a ghettoized community living in northern Italy.
Given what Arit said about cultural openness, listen to how near the end of the following sequence, in spite of this being a seemingly Jewish tale, Brandonia, Beauvau's mother, uses a clearly Christian reference to alleviate Count Dodon's concerns.
One night, when everyone in the camp was asleep, Dodon began to scream,
"Help me! Help me!"
Everyone heard this and woke up, filled with great alarm. His brother asked him what was wrong and what had so terrified him. Dodon said,
"I really must laugh at myself. It was just a dream I had, in which Beauvau rode me down and cut my throat."
But El Borgio said,
"Listen, not all dreams are lies. I swear to you on my oath, brother, that lad could well do you some harm. You mustn't let this happen, so take my advice and ask the boy's mother to have her son slain in secret."
Dodon said,
"You go quickly and tell my wife about the dream. I know that when she hears about it, she'll either banish him or have him killed. She loves me too much to let this dream come true."
El Borgio said,
"I'll do it gladly."
So he went back into town and told Brandonia everything. She was seized with a great fear, for she knew this dream could not be ignored. She said,
"Tell Dodon not to worry, that I'll do it for his sake. Tell him, let me take care of Beauvau. Then there won't be anything that he'd have to confess to a priest."
And when I'm talking about the Jews living in the Italian peninsula, it's really important to note that they themselves are very diverse. Yes, some of them are coming from Spain, the Ponentine Jews, it's true. Some of them are coming from the Levant, known as Levantini, yes. But others are also coming from Italy and also the Italian peninsula and parts of Europe and had been living there as far back, as I said, as Roman times. The ones who had been living back as far as Roman times were known as the Italiani. And then we have the Ashkenazi Jews coming from the Germanic lands who were called Tedeschi because Tedesco means German in Italian. And they had migrated during the Middle Ages. The Tedeschi or the German Italians then spoke Italian regional dialects, but they also spoke in Deutsch or Yiddish. And so this is a very multilingual world that we're speaking about, a very multicultural world within the communities of Northern Italian Jews. And of course, that multilingualism and multiculturalism then finds expression in the literature of the time.
So can you speak about the role of literature and other forms of writing in navigating these cultural waters and the power dynamics of this time and space?
Yes. So my own work I'll share for the last about 10, 15 years has focused on looking at minority communities working in early modern Italy, and especially focused on the Jews and also on the Ottoman Turks. And so I'm going to make a little excursion to speak about the Ottoman Turks and circle back to the Jews, because I think it's interesting to think about these communities and power dynamics in your question. So the Ottoman Turks often performed acrobatic daredevil acts in carnival time in Venice and in other places in northern Italy. And it seems to me that these works and these performances were equal parts virtuosic, displaying the ability of the Ottoman performers, but also making them perform, if not denigrating, then certainly dangerous, or as they were called, atti pericolosi, such as walking on a tightrope that is strung over deep water, for example. Similarly, the Jews were included in their creative works, both literary and performative, but again, relegated in a kind of denigrating way, perhaps, to the title of Ebrei, Jews. So yes, their writers were acknowledged as writers, but they were writers who were also given the title of Ebreo, to signal perhaps that their contribution is being offered from a position of marginality and deference, as well as difference. So literary and theatrical performances and their expressions were both a kind of way of including others, but also of highlighting their alterity and separateness. In our own way of thinking of cultures and races, maybe, we could think of separate but not equal as a strong way of thinking about this relationship. David Ruderman and Giuseppe Veltri, scholars of the period, have an edited book that's called Cultural Intermediaries, about the Jewish intellectuals such as Levita, who were living at this time and playing this role in the dangerous waters of cultural exchange and mixture at the time. And they emphasize the importance and the high degree of the cultural exchanges that were happening and taking place that indicate both an enormous amount of a cultural exposure to one another, but also, of course, as we see, the complexities of this exposure, which is always done on a level that is not totally even.
So these concerns about, again, about power, about there's exchange, but it may not be even. How does the book speak to this in terms of its use of language, the ways in which characters operate, in the spaces between being Christian and Jewish, somehow both and neither?
So to begin with, Bovobuch itself, as I said, already is borrowing from other cultures. When we look at the hero who's taken from this Bevis of Hampton, this 13th century, this Anglo-Norman tale, and then he's translated into French chansons de geste, which are being performed by the troubadours, and finally arrives in Italy when they're popularized as Bovo d'Antona by, you know, the late 1400s, and then make their appearance in Yiddish. They've already gone through so many different cultural cycling and recycling, frankly. Here we've got the hero, who was initially a Christian hero, grafted onto a Yiddish identity. That's not an easy leap to make, right? A man who curses, uses such terms as hilech, or diarrhea in Yiddish, and groans, oy vey, and he also curses, yimach shemam, you know, in Yiddish, but to all intents and purposes, otherwise functions as a Christian hero would. So there are chasanes that are being performed here, weddings, and there's mazel or luck that's being wished. Bovo's boys are given a bris, which is kind of shocking. I mean, where do you have a circumcision in a Christian chivalric romance? So the Jewish references are sprinkled everywhere, right? But fundamentally, the story remains the Christian heroic journey nonetheless.
Everyone took off their hats to him, shook his hand, and said,
Mazel tov! Congratulations!
But Duke Oglin, that villain, said to himself as soon as he heard about this,
May the hilech, diarrhea, take me if this marriage should ever come to pass. Yesterday he struck me, and I had to run away. I'll surely not forgive him that today.
Then, with his head all in bandages and his arm in a sling, he forced his way into the king's room. Duke Oglin greeted him and said,
Praise be to him who has caused those who were captive to be freed. But tell me, dear cousin mine, what's all this about a chasene, wedding? I cannot wish you much mazel, good fortune, for truly you have arranged an extremely poor chasene. Who in his whole life has ever heard of a greater shame and disgrace than that a king should give his daughter to a runaway knave from God knows where?
The king said,
Now heed me well. Your words displease me. How dare you speak to me so harshly? This should be no concern of yours. I've been looking for a good husband for Drusiana for some time, and now I happen to have found one. What do I care for some neighboring king's son who doesn't know pay from fay, his ABCs? Do not our own sages tell us that one should look for goodness in a son-in-law? For of what value is the yichus, pedigree, status, that one has from one's father and mother if he himself is not a good person? Therefore, cousin Oglin, be careful of what you say.
Again, the French chivalric romances had such a strong influence in Italian, and usually these are about Christian knights unfolding against Christian wars. But what happens in Elia Levita's hands is that the story becomes a kind of universalized story, and its particulars have a Jewish Yiddish flavoring here. So there's a lot of irony when we meet those moments, right? Because it seems so improbable that anybody, any knight would pray to the Boire, right, to the creator God in Yiddish, and that anybody who is a noble would talk about tuchuses, you know, tushies or behinds in such an account. It is a very jarring mixture of high and low and improbable. There's so much irony overlaid because it's so ridiculous to a Jewish ear to hear those particular expressions said in these moments of high intense tension in the text.
So the piece deals with these questions of power and cultural exchange and being both Christian and Jewish. And actually later on, we will talk about Islam in a later episode and the book's relationship to that faith tradition. In the meantime, though, can you touch briefly on the way in which Bova Buch uses both dress and food to differentiate between cultures?
Yes. Thank you. So let me say that I think costume or dress is being used in two very specific ways here. On the one hand, there is a lot of emphasis on clothing and identity. And that may be speaking to the fact that the Jews do have to, first of all, wear a marker and a badge of difference on them. And so they're very aware, keenly aware of the ways in which literally clothing marks you. Bovo himself, I should say, makes us even more aware of it because in his escapes and escapades, he takes on a lot of different costumes. And sometimes he's dressed as almost a peasant, and sometimes he's dressed as a, what they call in the text, a heathen with a turban. And sometimes because of that, he's even made or encouraged to speak, as the text says, in the heathen language or languages. And so I think that's interesting because it's talking about alterity, and it's a way of highlighting alterity through dress and through speech in the same way as the Jews are often marked this way. And, you know, when Bovo takes on the identity of a Muslim, as he's doing here, I think you're talking about one marginalized culture that is speaking about dealing with impersonating and the experience of another marginalized culture with a kind of understanding of that. But of course, it would be an allying against the heathen and with the Christian on the Jewish part. And maybe that alliance would be very important because in reality, so many Jews who were, let's say, coming out of the Iberian Peninsula were finding a safe home, yes, in Northern Italy, which is very Catholic, but also in the Ottoman world, which is, of course, Muslim. And so there is a kind of extension of the competition between the Muslim world and the Christian world that is happening and is being reflected in the literary work.
In this next reading, you will hear, as Irit points out, that Levita refers to the Muslim figures as heathens, a pejorative term. In a later episode, we will address, in greater detail, the challenging use of such a negative descriptor and the context in which it originally existed.
Then he stripped one stark naked and put on that man's heathen clothes. He also took a turban from one of the others and wrapped it around his own head, perhaps 100 turns. Now he looked just like a heathen. There were still 2 strong men up above, the king's very best. They had been waiting for the others to tie up Bovo. Then they had thought to pull everyone up at one time. They shouted down,
"Hey, haven't you tied him up yet? Hey, come on! What's taking you so long? Surely you've finished with him by now."
Bovo, who had learned the heathen language, shouted back,
"We're done. You can pull him up now. He's all tied up and can't escape."
Just these 2, then, pulled him up, but as soon as he had come over the edge, he quickly stuck his sword into the one and knocked the other one down. Then he jumped to his feet, started to run as though the devil from hell were chasing him, and quickly dashed through the city gate. Neither the watchman nor anyone else recognized him.
I also want to say that there is another level, I think, in which clothing and identity are important in this tale, and that is in that the Jewish readership would have been very knowledgeable about fabrics and clothing, because as I said, one of the ways in which they could make a living was through the strazzeria, through the secondhand cloth industry. And pawnbrokering and money lending and loans oftentimes involve pawning important and expensive items. And clothing was one such very expensive item at the time. So you've got a population that is very conversant in cloth.
As soon as the king got out of bed that morning, he ordered splendid clothes brought for Bovo, a precious gold necklace and a black silk cloak. Thus dressed, he walked through the town, attended by many servants.
His love interest, Drusiana, is described as wearing clothing of gold and pearls, and you could almost sense the detail there as speaking to an audience among whom were people who were very, very conversant in this. And I've spent some time in the archives, for example, in the State Archives of Mantua, and I've seen the receipts detailing the beautiful exchanges of filigreed fabric metallic work also that are described as being done by members of the Jewish community in Mantua and elsewhere, and are being actually purchased in many cases by the Christian nobility.
Then Bovo went over to the hall and watched the dancing for a while, looking all around for Drusiana. When he saw her, she was wearing gold and countless pearls and a gown made entirely of golden cloth.
And so I think that the fact that we have so much emphasis on the clothing, yes, it's for a female readership, which may have anyway been interested in it, but also it's for people who's professionally had a real understanding of the intricacy, the detail, the cost of these. But this text also, it seems to me, is very, very full with copious mentioning of food, especially later in the text, when the female characters become more dominant, when Drusiana takes more of a role, where Margherita, who we haven't even discussed yet, takes on more of a role, and where food at parties, weddings, celebrations, events is described in a great deal of detail. And I just will mention for the moment that nowhere in that detail is pork or chazel mentioned at all. Nothing treif finds its way into the menu. And, you know, that's a little bit surprising. You'd kind of expect in a Christian tale that there would be, you know, something cooking on the spittle that's non-kosher. But here, that is excised for sure from any mention. And instead, you have many more familiar types of food that find their way into the story and the narrative.
Then he went into a building where he found many chickens in a coop. He said,
"I'll take all of those."
The monks dare not say a word. Then he found a chest full of rice, wheat, simukim, raisins, grapes, and figs, as well as a whole sack full of spices. He gathered together some cooked things as well. Then he took a great pot of fat and a bag of salt, stuffed a sack full of bread, and took down some smoked tongues from where they had been hanging next to the fireplace. He found a cask of boiled down wine. It was so old the hoops were about to pop off the barrel, and he said,
"We can drink that."
He gathered all this in a heap, and then took all manner of kitchen utensils, platters, spoons, plates, a pot or two, like those you pay 3 hellers for, and a pan for cooking eggs in. Then he went down into the cellar and drew off 2 large bottles of wine.
Now that we have heard about some of the particulars of the text, Erit and I return to discussing the way in which Jewish identity does or does not operate in the book, and the kinds of cultural questions addressed therein.
Something that occurs to me is a lot of the choices of the ways in which Bovo and the world he's in are Jewish are very surface-level cosmetic, right? That they are, oh, a bris is happening, or expressions that are Jewish. Mm-hmm. But the way in which Bovo operates and the culture in which he operates is based on a culture of power, right? I'm born into a royal space with all sorts of servants and helpers. There's counts and queens and all of these things that in the context in which Jews lived at the time wouldn't have been attainable.
Right.
And so that's what makes it Christian, right? Not any religious iconography.
Oh, yeah.
It's what makes it a Christian context is about power and about the structures that went along with that power. And so what I'm curious about is, how much of this do you think is about just literally using the dominant structure to tell a story? And how much has an aspect of being aspirational, of this idea of escape and fantasy is about achieving that which is not achievable for these marginalized or disempowered people?
There's a way in which, for the reader, it seems to me there is something aspirational and imaginative fantasy that is happening in this work. And I think that in that sense, it's the same as when you have like a Jewish playwright like Leonid de Somi, you know, who writes, who's very active in the 16th century, relatively the same time and is working in Mantua primarily. And he writes the first play in Hebrew that we have, but he also writes texts such as The Three Sisters, Le Tre Sorelle in Italian, that seem to be, for all intents and purposes, Christian works. There's nothing particularly Jewish about the text when he writes some of them in Italian. And in fact, he writes for, you know, a literary academy. He's able to work in that sphere. But I think because he's oftentimes writing for the community of Jewish performers to perform the texts, that something different happens. It's similar, I think, to when we had, you know, now we have color conscious casting, right? Or race consciousness in the way in which we cast. But in the 90s, it was very common to say colorblind casting. And in that regard, if you chose a person of color to play a dominant role, it's a little bit like what Hamilton, right, was so successful in doing. If you imagine people in positions of authority and power, but the actors' bodies are actually people who are otherwise marginalized by culture, then you're participating in a kind of cultural intervention. And I think something similar happens here with the Yiddish.
Thank you for listening to this first episode of Bovo Buch, Chivalric Romance, Cultural Collision. The next investigates the role of women in the text. This episode featured actors Joe Jordan and Diana Tanaka, with Joshua Wolf Coleman as the author. Readings throughout the series from the English translation by Jerry C. Smith are performed by actors Joshua Wolf Coleman, Joe Jordan, Julie Lockhart, Rebecca Rasmussen, Clay Steakley, Diana Tanaka, and Mark McLean Wilson. Miri Korol of the California Institute for Yiddish Culture and Language provided the reading of the Yiddish excerpts and guidance on Yiddish pronunciation. The music featured was composed by Salomone Rossi and performed by the Vocal Ensemble for Theater Dybbuk's production of Hell Prepared, musical director Fahed Siadat. The series is edited by Mark McLean Wilson. Scholarship is provided by Arit Jaffe Berg. The podcast is produced by Theater Dybbuk and presented in collaboration with Judaism Unbound.
And so, dear sirs, ponder this.
How quickly did Drusiana send for
him? It sorely grieved Bovo to see
so
many of
Let's let Bovo sail many a mile.
Shout down and tell her that I won't let her
Bovo now went into the great hall and found it.
I haven't seen the likes of him for a long time. He must be a real fighting cock.
Staft der zu besser gesang. Dem konich nor sagen mein Dank.